From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made several weeks into April when the New York State Legislature finally passed a New York State budget. When that deal was done, it was, as we've said on this program in the past, it was kind of classic Albany. At the center was a housing plan that, at least according to the New York Times, made people on all sides upset. The governor battled the legislature on school funding and, in some ways, lost. And there are plenty of other budget priorities to discuss, from childcare to taxes to economic development to migrant support and more. And we're continuing our series of conversations with members of the New York State Legislature, talking about what is in this budget, what is not, what the priorities should be going forward, and what they think the big headlines are. And from the 136th Assembly District, Assemblymember Sarah Clark is back with us today. Assemblymember Clark, welcome. Thank you for being with us here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Is there a single big headline that comes out of this year's budget to you?
No. No single headline. It was, I feel like it's always this rush and push, and we were obviously a couple of weeks late and had to do a few extenders. And so by the time it's pushed, by the time it's passed, everyone's kind of just a sigh of relief and they forget to ask what's actually in it. So that's where, we're trying to make sure people understand the good, the not so good, and the still need to be done buckets that we have in the budget. I don't think it was like something everybody was celebrating. I do think there were some good things in it, but obviously a lot more work to do to make sure we're getting all the resources and funding the things that we need to fund.
So we're going to talk about issue by issue coming up, but I want to start. The last time we had a member of the legislature on the program, it was your colleague, Jen Lunsford, and it was right after the news broke about District Attorney Sandra Dorley of Monroe County and kerfuffle? Worse than that? I mean, the really hard-to-believe video that came out of Webster Police. And Assemblymember Lunsford was rather eager to talk about that. She was had very strong views. And since then, what I don't know is, where is the process and is there a legislature role in this? There were a lot of questions about who would have authority, who would investigate, who would ultimately make a final call on any discipline. So can you just kind of update us on what you know about who is involved here?
From my understanding is that the Attorney General's office is involved to some extent. I don't know what powers they have or don't have in terms of the ultimate consequences. We do know, and we've had the attention of the governor to forward to the prosecutorial misconduct sort of group that's been formed. But again, I think that's very new. People don't quite understand what teeth does it have, what role can it play. But we do know that does exist, and we're hoping they may be able to have a role to influence some consequences here or whatever it may be as they look into it. I think both my colleague and I have some very, very, I have publicly said that I think she should resign. I think there's mistakes. I mean, when you're the top prosecutor, speeding is a mistake, right? That's a mistake many of us make every day. And if you're pulled over for it and you are the top prosecutor, top lawyer in the country or the county, then you say, yes, I broke this law and I'm sorry and whatever. But this wasn't about a speeding ticket. This was about so much more. And between just everything that happened in terms of how she treated a police officer, but also the danger by which she put most motorists and officers in terms of traffic stops and not following commands and pulling over and doing what the rest of us have to do. I really think it's if she ends up having a real moment where she redeems herself, that's great. I just don't see how you can continue to serve as a prosecutor when your job is to prosecute these exact crimes and your behavior is exactly what you've been screaming about for years is the exact wrong thing to do. And so how do you ever be effective afterwards?
I have in the past made the mistake of thinking that certain events could rise above politics. I felt that way in the early days of the pandemic, and no, I was wrong. I felt that way briefly in this case. I saw the video and I thought, this will unite people because it is so egregious. And then it was followed by, days later, the district attorney putting out a statement that was filled with lies about what had actually happened. And only when we saw the actual video was it clear. So I thought that would unite people. Instead, I want to ask you about one development that happened, which is that we see the video, which looks to me like a pretty anti-cop video. I mean, like, for all the talk about supporting law enforcement, I haven't seen a whole lot of videos that are more just absolutely dismissive and sneering at police than that. And then we had the local Republican Party chair, Patrick Riley, put out a statement saying that the video does not supersede decades of service from District Attorney Sandra Dorley, and that the Republican Party welcomes the Democrats' newfound support for law enforcement in such its own sort of sneering, backhanded way. And it occurred to me that there would be no actual rising above politics in this moment. But what did you make of that, this idea that, well, Democrats welcome to supporting law enforcement?
Well, I think this is often the political mess and soup that we're always in of having, you know, when you question things or you have different ideas, that sometimes people can misinterpret them as anti-police or anti-law enforcement, when really you're just trying to get to better solutions so that everybody's safe, both our law enforcement officers and our community. And I think this has been sort of dogging the Democratic Party for a long time, as this somehow makes us anti-law enforcement or anti-police, when it's the exact opposite. We're just trying to make our community work in a way where everybody is safe, everybody can do their job, and that it's a struggle. It's not easy. These are huge challenges that we have, and figuring out answers has been really difficult. I do find it just fascinating. I have called for people in my own party to step down. I think I was one of the first voices, particularly upstate, demanding that our governor, our former governor, step
Andrew
down.
Cuomo, yeah.
And I hold people accountable. These are very high-level positions, and it comes with a lot of responsibility. And some of that responsibility is that you have to be able to say when you're in it that you can no longer be effective, that you have broken the public's trust enough to not be able to be effective. There are amazing people out there who can be DA, and the sense that we're making it political as a Democratic Party by asking her to resign or investigate or step down or whatever is laughable, when we do it to our own party, and we have, and there's countless examples of it, because we should hold people accountable regardless of their party. It's actually that statement and the Republicans who've made this a political issue when it shouldn't be. And I can tell you, when I went back to when we went back into session after that, our Republican colleagues downstate were just disgusted and just like, something's got to happen, right?
That your Republican colleagues were.
Yeah. And hearing from Republicans in people's districts who were just like completely flabbergasted.
Well, it became a national story.
Yeah. And yeah. Everyone's like, I don't understand why she's still there. But it's only here where there's, and I can tell you, even rank and file Republicans have also still expressed some real dismay and some not sure that she has the ability to really continue on.
Well, my sense of the notion of backing police is that if your claim is that you back the blue until there's a confrontation with someone who's more powerful than police, because in most interactions, police have more power. They are armed enforcers of the law of the state. But in the confrontation with the DA has more power. And if you don't back police in those spots, if you don't back them on January 6th, then you don't really back the police. What you really support is just pure power. Whoever has more power in any given situation.
Or power in the way you think it should be used, instead of understanding that real power is a safe community. Real power is everybody's life and everybody's job and everyone having the tools they need to do, being safe and having better outcomes. I mean, the January 6th is one of the families who lost a police officer there has been very vocal and in their disappointment that people who say they back the blue have not been more vocal about who has lost their life there and the reasons why they lost their life, officers that lost their life. It was somehow, you know, swept under the rug as, you know, no need to look here, no need to talk about it. And so it is really frustrating to when what I really truly want is, you know, whether it's a mental health crisis, whether it's our youth who, you know, need more services and need different pathways, and we really need to invest in them and give them resources, and our neighborhoods that need desperate investment and revitalization and working with them. You know, these are the things that we need to do, and doing it will help keep our police officers safe. And that's the goal. But somehow it's seen as you don't care, or you're just about the power. And
what, right. And that's why I feel like an incident like this is bigger than just one moment. It's about the wielding of power, and it's about how a very powerful member of the community treats the police and sets an example. I mean, it is absolutely plausible that other people will get pulled over and will give police the same kind of treatment because the district attorney did.
2 weeks before that incident, a person got pulled over in Syracuse and did not pull over and was followed to his house, and another officer was called in, and that person shot and killed two police officers. This exact situation. And it puts everybody in danger. This is what I'm talking about. This is so serious. And to make it political, to make it anything other than that is... It's just really frustrating, because we have to have people here who are who have the public trust to be an authentic voice in this conversation.
A couple other quick points here. You said you do think that the district attorney should resign. Do you expect her to be removed?
I don't know. I mean, that really the only person who has the power, as we've started to look into it, is the governor. And I don't know if there will be enough of what she might need to make that call. I've not had conversations with her about it. It saddens me that somebody can be in these positions and not take on their own responsibility with it. I mean, we did see Governor Cuomo, I think he maybe saw some writing on the wall that there was a path the legislature and others were going down that might have ended up in his removal, and he took control of it and he stepped down on his own terms. And I at least am thankful for that, that he had enough to understand that there was no sort of rebounding in this, and that the position and the people of New York are more important than he is. And I hope that can happen here, too.
Okay. And do you expect a resolution on this one way or another anytime soon?
Your guess is as good as mine.
You don't know. Okay. Talking to Assembly Member Sarah Clark from District Number 136. In the New York State Legislature. And, you know, we're supposed to be talking about a budget and what's in it and what's not and what the priorities are. But, you know, this has certainly been an incident and issue that has tied up a lot of attention. It's become a national story, and there are still questions about where it goes. So let me move to talk about some other issues here with the Assembly Member. And listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Sarah Clark is from Assembly District Number 136. We've had some of her colleagues already on in the wake of the passage of the budget, and we're going to be having... essentially, everyone is invited. We want you to know that. It doesn't matter your party or your district number. If you're in our area and you're serving in the legislature, we want you on this program, and we always appreciate the chance to do just that here. We can entertain some of your feedback in just a moment here, but let me just ask you, what was the biggest disappointment from budget season for you?
I mean, some were small. We really were trying to get a different number for our early intervention services. This is something my colleague and Assemblywoman Lunsford and I have been beating the drum on for years. The housing package, I just still don't think it did enough for upstate. I really need to, you know, we're still sort of seeing what the ramifications are of it and what it could mean for upstate, but I just don't think it had enough. We have to build more housing up here. We have to address some of the affordability issues in a different way. So like the Housing Access Voucher Program, I really wish the expansion upstate had been there and the money for it. I think some of the bigger challenges, the bigger things really is around healthcare and Medicaid dollars. Our nursing homes are in complete crisis right now. And they, because they're in crisis, the whole healthcare system is in crisis. So we were able to do some things to start alleviating that sort of clog of where we're having issues in terms of health delivery. But we are going to have to keep fighting that. The CDPAP program, which is one of our most successful programs to help people who are taking care of either intellectual developmentally disabled adults, our seniors and others, you know, that got moved very quickly to a completely new one fiduciary, one FI system that's going to happen in a year. So we have to go from 300 or 600 or however many you say we have all the way down to one. I'm very nervous about what that's going to look like. And I just feel like we didn't have enough input in that at the end of that process. And all of a sudden it just got thrown into the budget and we kind of all had to say yes. And so those are some of the big things that I was a little worried about.
Rebecca and Charlie, I'll take your call in just a second. Let me just hit a couple of the points that the assembly member touched on. On housing, the New York Times described the housing package as being, quote, a hard-fought plan to increase housing supply and extend protections for New York's existing tenants. And while it is not yet clear just how durable or wide-ranging those protections might be, lawmakers nonetheless are hopeful the plan will stem the tide of middle-income New Yorkers fleeing the state for places like New Jersey and Connecticut, end quote. And how to increase the supply? Well, the Times says it's using a substantial new tax break with strong labor standards baked in to incentivize the construction of housing with an affordability component. Is it, I mean, like, so what is enough? Like, what's the right mix
so
here?
New York City has much more of that really baked in. Upstate is more sort of towns can choose. And which of these plans, that you know, it's still really up to towns to decide they want to be a pro-housing community.
Are you comfortable with that arrangement?
I want local control. It's hard, right? Because I want locals to have control. But I also know that there's so many communities. I know supervisors have come here on your show and said that they don't want multi-housing units and they don't want to do these things.
Yep.
And that how we, you know, can we incentivize enough with enough sort of carrots to get them to yes? That's still to be determined. But we have to build more housing. We have to build more dense housing, multifamily housing, as well as single family, and increase home ownership and do some of those things. We have to get a handle on short-term rentals. We just finally passed the bill in the Assembly and the Senate to create, and hopefully the governor will sign or pass it out of committee. We still have to pass it on the floor. But to get a hold of the short-term rental market, which I think is wreaking havoc. I just heard there's 250 Airbnbs in the town of Irondequoit that they know of. And that takes housing off the market, and that creates new forces and dynamics that make it more expensive and harder for others. And if we don't start to get a handle on that, we can't even make a plan. We don't even know what the next step is. And all of these things have to happen. We'll see if the carrots are enough. Otherwise, we're going to have to continue to have conversations about how we get more housing built.
Is there a single mechanism that will lead to more housing supply that you think is,
again, I think it's achievable. Probably the hard part here is that there is none.
Okay.
Right? It's multifaceted, and
because people say, "Well, build more housing," but I mean, I know it's not that simple,
right?
And especially when it comes to "quote unquote" affordable housing, and what even is affordable?
Correct.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to be kind of facile with this idea that, well, just build more housing, but if that is the goal, you know, how do we get there? And part of the point you're making, I think, is there's not one single magic bullet for that.
Correct. There is not. But I will say we've looked at affordability and we've started to not just build more around affordability, but start to lower the income level of eligibility. And it costs more for the state to do that, right? Because we have to put more money into that. But that has been flagged for us multiple times, is that what we think is affordable doesn't truly match the incomes and what people are making in the community.
The tenant protections in this budget are not quite what you would call good cause. And the Times writes that these protections in the budget strengthen tenant protection statewide. Under the agreement, landlords of many market rate units will be forced to justify rent increases beyond certain thresholds and required to offer lease renewals in most cases, protections inspired by but are weaker than the proposed legislation known as good cause eviction. Is that a fair analysis?
It is. It's also, obviously, again, something that's just for New York City. Every other community has to opt in. There's a lot of flexibility on the opting in to design a program that works for your community. So first, you have to have the community decide they want it. And second, you have to then figure out what does it look best like? How does it best serve our community to have those strengthened protections? I would say, and I point to this study a lot, there was six cities in California, three that had what we would call good cause. They call it something different, and three that didn't. And honestly, it didn't change really much the eviction rates. But what it did was it changed the efficiency, because the cases that shouldn't have been brought were no longer getting brought because it was very, very clearly defined who should be coming before for an eviction proceeding. And it actually, so this is why sometimes I struggle with landlords, you know, particularly large landlords that think this is a bad thing. If anything, it made it more efficient because it was very clear cut. It was clear cut for the judges. It was clear cut for landlords and tenants. But it also, and it gives so many more protections for investments you put in, assessments that go up, taxes that, these are all very understandable things. But, you know, and I understand the nuisance piece and, you know, neighbors not being neighborly and people want the ability to evict in those cases. And there are very clear ways where you still can. But we also know that there are people who are evicted just because they're poor, just because they may have a disability, just for all these other factors. And we have to figure out a way to ensure there's some protections for them, that if they're doing the right thing, if they're paying their rent and, you know, making sure, but they may be a little different or they whatever, that's not a reason that they lose housing.
All right, let me get to your phone calls and some feedback. Rebecca in Chilai. Hello, Rebecca. Go ahead.
Hello. So I had gone to a legislative reception earlier in the year, prior to when the budget was passed, and it was hosted by a nursing organization. And so I was talking to some of the legislators after during their the Q&A session, and I was talking about community college funding. And people were like, oh, yeah, you know, community college is really important. And I kind of talked with some people about changing the funding model, which would be a good thing for community colleges. But so I was talking to a legislator and he was like, oh yeah, you know, we think community college funding is really important, but you know, there's nobody who's really willing to like fight for that. And I was like, how's that? And he said, you know, like nobody's willing to spend their political capital, like, you know, arguing for more funding for community colleges. It's just not something anybody's willing to do right now. And I was like, what? You know, and I was sort of hoping for like a Mr. Smith goes to Washington, like inspiring government speech. And I got no, like nobody wants to risk any of their political capital to like put themselves out there to like really push for community college funding. Like we all know it's a good thing, but nobody's really willing to do that. And I left that reception kind of depressed. I was kind of wondering if the Assemblywoman could kind of like speak to that and what people can do if they don't have, you know, like a big lobbying organization behind them to sort of, you know, affect change or at least have their voices heard.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you might have been stretching, but I think you were actually raising your hand at one point.
When you said no one's willing to put their
political capital.
I raised my hand.
Assemblymember Clark raised
your
hand in the studio.
Willing.
All right, go ahead, Assemblymember.
And thank you for that, and thank you caring so much about our community colleges. I would argue, push back a little on this legislator, whoever it was. I can tell you I've sat in conference, and there is a big group of folks who are loud and vocal about community colleges. We fought to get some more involved in some of our workforce training programs that were, you know, entirely going to rest in ESD. And we really pushed back to say, no, we want our community colleges involved. We should be giving them the money and the resources. They already do it. Our rural counterparts particularly love our community colleges. MCC is their main office, their main campus is in my district. You know, we have fought hard to keep a floor at their funding level. The problem is it is slightly complex because it's a match, right? It's a city-county state. So if we raise too much, that puts pressure on the county and others that then they too have to raise, or it gets, and there's also a complex way by which we count full-time students there. So, you know, in some formulas, it looks like enrollment's dropped, and others, it looks like it hasn't. And so we are trying to work through all of that. But I can tell you there is a loud, loud chorus of folks who scream about our community colleges and ensuring they they are on the map. They understand that we need to get them resources. And we have not done. I mean, we have done a lot in historic investments in SUNY and CUNY, including the community colleges. But it's because of that funding match and the way they do it, they don't get the same amount of resources. And they've been asking for parity. And it is truly something we need to fight for.
Anything you want to add, Rebecca, before we let you go?
I would just say, yeah, like I work on a statewide like faculty, community college faculty group. And, you know, the community colleges asked for additional $97 million this year in the budget. And that ask was actually asking for the state to match what the counties and what the tuition is bringing into the community colleges. So I feel like it's a little bit disingenuous to say if the state gave us more money, the counties would have to too, because the state's $97 million short.
It depends a little bit, but I think we should talk in the fall and make sure we're ready and to go into the budget cycle to make sure that that is really on the radar. You know, it was crazy at the end, some operating dollars, and even for SUNY, sort of were on the risk of being pulled out of the budget, and we were fighting to get that in. I do think we need to really raise that $97 million piece. By the time it got to my ears in the budget, it was a little late, and we didn't have really that mechanism by which to ensure it got in. So that really has to be shouted, I think, from the rooftops as we head into next session.
Well, WXXI News recently was reporting on staffing cuts that could affect about 24 positions at MCC. And so there's a lot going on with higher ed that let me just ask one follow-up question, and thank you, Rebecca. I appreciate that phone call. You know, we see Wells College closing, private school down on Cayuga Lake. We see reports of other schools thinking about closing or consolidation. And some of it goes back to pandemic, and we haven't seen enrollment reach the levels of pre-pandemic. So I understand Wells is on MCC, and there's a lot of apples and oranges, or apples to different apples. But MCC, we keep hearing that community colleges have a great sort of position for the future because there's a lot of students who might not want to go to a four-year program. They might want something more flexible, closer to home. And yet, MCC officials are saying the cuts they're talking about are because they have a historic decline in enrollment themselves. And I don't know what to do about that. I don't know what you feel like the state should do about that. But how do you view that picture right now?
So all our SUNY and community college campuses were required to do this sort of like enrollment plan, like forecasting, also sort of partnered together with what their plan was to increase enrollment. I think in MCC's case, you know, from the numbers that I've seen and from folks that I've talked to who work there or part of it, is that it's maybe not just the enrollment itself, it's the retention piece, right? So they're getting the same number of students who may be starting, but we're not keeping them for some reason. And that is something that I think both the state, you know, thinking out of the box for different resources, as well as our community colleges and our community partners can figure out what are the barriers that are making people leave? Why are they not staying? And what can we be doing? We did increase TAP. This was my huge thing. I've had these two bills since I came in. So we're increasing the TAP income threshold for families from $80,000 to $125,000. And we're increasing the minimum award from $500 to $1,000. So we're really hoping that more and more folks, the affordability piece might be a little easier on families and students. We still have that challenge between some kids who come from high school and go right into community colleges, and they sort of aren't maybe college ready yet. Yet MCC doesn't get reimbursed for those courses if they're non-credit courses. And so how do we support MCC in those places? And I think that's the reason maybe kids leave. You know, I just did three courses and I got no credits, right? Well, let's figure out a different way to do that.
Let me put a fine point on what the assembly member just mentioned about TAP. That's the tuition assistance program. For the first time in decades, raising the income eligibility for TAP, the tuition assistance program, from $80,000 to $125,000.
That's my bill.
That's your bill.
That's my bill.
And that's more than a 50% increase in that that income eligibility. It's a huge change.
It's a huge change. And what we saw, we actually did a hearing on this in the fall. It was interesting because the enrollment numbers weren't matching the lack of enrollment or the decline in enrollment wasn't matching the decline in TAP. The decline in TAP usage was like two or three or four times more because more and more families were becoming not eligible for it. We hadn't updated it in decades, and obviously incomes have changed, and we had to adjust for it. It's historic. I mean, the program's only been around for 50 years, and it's been over 20 since we changed the income eligibility. So it was a huge win.
Also, the minimum award goes from 500 to 1,000.
And we took care of the independent student piece. This has been a really thorn in our side. If you don't have a family, if you are an independent student, your income eligibility for TOP was $10,000 a year, which just made no sense. We got that up to $30,000 a year. So that was another huge, huge win that took care of this just strange way that we didn't support people who were independent, no longer a dependent on a family when it comes to IRS and all those things.
Talking to Assembly Member Sarah Clark, can I give you some space to talk about child care?
Absolutely.
Okay, so a little bit of the backdrop of child care is, and it is no surprise or mystery to families trying to afford child care to find out that it is hard to afford, but then the conundrum seems to be child care is expensive, but child care workers don't get paid a lot. And there's a lot of turnover, and it's hard to retain staff. And there's issues with early intervention services in that regard. And then there's questions on what the state's reimbursement should be and what that should look like. And it's been an ongoing, years-long battle. And what Assemblymember Clark describes, and I'm going to give you all the space to kind of get into the details here, is the situation this where you didn't get everything you wanted, but it was enough to feel like a win. Is that correct? Okay.
It's enough to at least say we're still at the table, but
all right, so take us through it.
So childcare, part of the issue, and it was so funny. I was just doing an interview in the Capital Region on this, and afterwards I'm like, you're probably not going to be able to use any of that, are you? Because I talk about it so much in the details because there is no easy, just do this.
Our listeners want the wonky stuff.
Okay,
on this
I'm ready for the wonky stuff. So childcare, it's the math equation that doesn't work, right? We know the workforce in childcare is not paid enough. They are not paid. You can make more money working in a fast food restaurant and retail, yet you're taking care of and watching children at the most critical age of development and making sure families feel safe for themselves to go to work and parents for them to go to their own jobs. And we pay them nothing. I mean, we pay them minimum wage. And the problem is if you just say, okay, let's just raise their rate, their pay to, mirror that more of a teacher or whatever it may be, who's going to pay that? Families can barely afford it now. It's more expensive to send your child to childcare than it is to SUNY. So who's going to pay it? So if families can't pay it, does the state have a role here to figure out a way to come up with a true cost of childcare at the level we want it to be and figure out a way to invest? Now, we have increased subsidies for families up to a family of four up to $99,000 a year, which is huge. We're leading the state or we're leading the country with that. It's great. But the moment you make a dollar more, you lose everything. Well, that also doesn't make sense. I mean, families can't all of a sudden pick up a $12,000, $14,000 bill because someone makes five more dollars a year more. So we really have to address that sort of cliff issue. And who is going to do that? Who is going to pick up the tab? We need a dedicated source of revenue. It can't just be a fight. We helped with some money last year and again, a little more this year with these sort of one-off bonuses to sort of shore up some providers, give them a little extra dollars to give their workforce. But that's not sustainable and not everyone gets it. And it's just really inequitable and we're not solving the problem. And what we're seeing because of it is people leaving the private workforce and workforce shortages everywhere we go. New parents, one of them is making a decision to just stay home and not return back to the workforce. And that's having a real effect everywhere else. So we have a childcare workforce issue and we have a regular workforce issue. And people can't get slots. There are people that I know that can't, particularly for that early years, they can't find slots. And again, it's all tied together. We have a few. So we did a little to help continue to sort of maybe keep the Band-Aid on the system, but we didn't do enough to really start to solve the issue. We got one of my other bills that I've been fighting for is this differential pay. So if you're a child care provider, you know, our healthcare professions, our first responders, those who may work nights, weekends. I mean, if you can't find childcare 9 to 5, imagine trying to find childcare at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. It's almost impossible. So we've been fighting to create a differential pay that's higher to pay those providers who are willing to take those families and care for children at those times. And so we did get a 10% bump. We were asking for 15. 10% is, it feels like a slight win, not a huge win, but at least it got people's attention. And you know, before, people weren't even listening when I talked about differential pay or non-traditional hours, nights, weekends. And now they're at least finally talking about it because more and more families are asking for it and there's just no options. We have a couple bills that we're heading towards in the end of the session that we think will help a little. Presumptive eligibility is this big one. We got some of the soft language last year that allowed counties to opt in. This is the idea that if you presumptively are eligible for child care subsidies, we know your income, I don't know, we know you already qualify for something else, we can presume you're going to be eligible. But the application process takes a long time. And normally, without presumptive eligibility, you just don't get child care till you're approved. Well, we're trying to say, let's get you into child care, particularly if you have to go to work. And we'll continue on with the application. And then when you get approved, you know, the federal dollars, the block grant dollars that the counties have will all be fine. And they will pay for those weeks that you were in child care. Well, last year, we put the onus on local governments that if a family was ultimately deemed ineligible, didn't finish the application, whatever it may be, that the county had to pay for it. Well, the federal rule came out this year that said, no, we want to encourage presumptive eligibility. We will pay for it. We will allow you to use our federal dollars, even if the family is deemed ineligible ultimately. And so we're trying to get that into the final budget to get counties now not to opt in, but to have to use this process as by the way by which they approve child care subsidies. Nobody should have to, when they get a new job, wait 4 weeks for child care if they qualify for it. Why? I mean, either that person's going to lose the job because they can't go. They may put their child in an unsafe spot, which we've seen tragedies happen when people don't have a safe spot to put their children in. And it makes providers really confused and makes their life harder because you don't know when you're going to get a family in or not, and you can't really make those decisions. There's such an easier way to do this.
So let me connect what you just said to a conversation we had yesterday. We had Dr. Michal Raz from the University of Rochester, who has a book on, it's called Abusive Policies. It's about the history in this country of how we define child abuse and how the system deals with that. And I'm not talking about, because she in her book is not talking about physical violence or sexual violence. We're talking about claims of neglect or parental behavior that is jeopardized as a child that could lead to a removal of a child from household, separation of families. And what Dr. Raz believes very strongly is that we have overly criminalized poverty. We've overly criminalized the hard decisions you just described. So childcare during certain hours of the day, the middle of the day, that's hard enough. Childcare for people who work overnight hours or odd different hours that are, you know, maybe not typical, I guess, are really hard to find. Every family who's raised kids has to eventually come to the conclusion, like, is my kid old enough to be home alone? Is that okay? Like, my 12-year-old's home right now. He's on his own. He's okay, I think. I don't think there's a law that says he can't be. But that was a process. Like, are you okay with this? How about an hour? And then, you know, parents who have a lot of resources, like I do, and advantages, you can work that out slowly over time. Families that don't are making a hard call, and maybe at a younger age that they'd like, saying, I may have to leave this child alone for a little while. I don't know what to do. There's no care. I have to work this job, or now I can't get a paycheck. And then all of a sudden, the state calls and says, like, you're being investigated for child abuse. And what Dr. Raz is saying is, that is too broad a definition. We are separating families, and we have to change it to from a punitive model to a more resource and support model. Do you agree with that?
100%. I was actually at a mandated reporting hearing this fall, and you know, we heard the same thing over and over again. We're criminalizing poverty. Families are coming to the state, to their local county agencies, asking for help, and instead they're getting an investigation. On the childcare piece, I mean, we have our own tragedy here in Rochester, the child who lost his life at Tim Hortons because his parent had to bring him there. That was a lack of childcare issue. And those things just should not be happening in our society with as many resources as we have and people who can put their heads together and solve some of these problems. And it will take some resources and a dedicated funding stream to shore up childcare to get it to where we need to. But I always say around childcare, if we solved it as a state, if we collectively spread out the economic needs across the state and came up with a solution that really helped everyone, businesses would flock here. I mean, this is a problem nationwide. We have, lost 3 million people that didn't return to work after the COVID pandemic. People would like, oh, you have childcare figured out? I can open my business there and I don't have to worry about it. I really firmly believe that we could do that if we did that on childcare.
And it would be a big sell for the state.
It would. I would be out marketing it. I hope our governor would be out marketing it. You know, we do have the Childcare Availability Task Force, which is supposed to give us our universal childcare roadmap in the next 2 years, you know, next year or so, which hopefully will give us what we need to do. Although I would say I know most of what will probably be in that report.
But when we talk about criminalizing poverty, it seems like a vague term. The last few minutes, that is what we mean when we talk about criminalizing poverty. The flip side is, I got some feedback yesterday from listeners who said, if you can't afford to take care of a child, don't have a child. You know, don't put a child in that spot. And where are you on that?
Well, it's hard to say that when, you know, more and more people are living on a minimum wage that can't afford them anything. I mean, basically, they can't afford housing. They can't afford children. Like, I mean, are you just saying you work 40 hours a week and you can afford nothing? So sorry, your life, you can do nothing. But maybe, you know, live on the streets and that's about it. The truth is that incomes have not kept up with costs. I mean, you made minimum wage 40 years ago and you could afford these things. And so I just think it's an unfair when we haven't allowed those costs, if we haven't figured out a way to ensure people can still do those things, take care of their basic needs, then we're just setting everyone up for failure. And I don't think that's the answer. I don't think it's don't have kids. And not to mention, I mean, there's so many situations that happen after you have a kid, right? Like, you may be able to think you can, and then you lose your job, and you have to take a different one, or you lose your housing, or your relationship breaks up, and you're getting divorced, and now all of a sudden you're a single parent trying to navigate this world. There are other reasons after you've already had a child that could really cause this upheaval. So I just think that's really not a helpful solution.
I suspect you think it's inconsistent to say, well, if you're struggling with poverty, then don't have a child. By the way, I want to limit access to contraception and take away abortion rights.
And not give you health care and not...
You think that's inconsistent?
Yes. Yeah. It's all very inconsistent.
Okay.
But we, on the mandated reporting hearing, I mean, we know that 85% of the calls that go into CPS just in our county alone are on basic need, you know, on that neglect issue, which a fair amount of those are just people judging, you know, a family's inability to provide certain things for their kids and feel like it's putting them in danger. Whether it is or not, obviously we need to solve and figure out a way to do that. But even if it is, can't we just figure out a way to support that family instead of adding more trauma to that family by, you know, removing a child or opening an investigation or whatever it may be?
All right, let me get some more listener feedback. One of your constituents, Jerry, says, a two-parter. Number one, the Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct is either not staffed or only very recently staffed, and its last member was appointed only in the past weeks. It is effectively impotent. Do you agree with that?
I share those concerns.
You share those concerns. I guess we're going to learn more in the weeks to come about that. Okay. And then separately, why is there no bicyclist safety law update? Who and why is holding it up every year?
I don't know. I know that is one of my colleagues has a bill to do some. I think he's talking about the space you give a bicyclist on a road and ensuring that they are safe as you pass them in vehicles. I mean, there's a couple things here. One, we have started to really invest in complete streets and figure out ways that public dollars that repave roads ensure that you're not just thinking about cars anymore. You're thinking about walkers, you're thinking about bikers, and you're thinking about all these other things. We have to continue that model. And that also includes a robust and strong public transit system, the intermodal station that's going to have all its wonderfulness, and we're excited to connect it to the bus station. But that bill specifically on safety as you pass bikers, it is not my legislation, so I actually cannot tell you what is the holdup.
I think Jerry is saying, well, just because it's not your legislation doesn't mean you shouldn't care about it.
I absolutely care about it. I'm just not in the weeds on it like the sponsor of it is. I'm happy to try to get some feedback from the sponsor of it. It is sometimes a process to get bills over and legislation over the finish line. And I myself am trying to, at the last 9 days of session, do some great work myself. But it is, you know, you have to make sure that there's all the stakeholders are heard. And sometimes there's stakeholders that oppose each other. And then you get to a stalemate and you have to figure out a solution.
Barb writes to say, I did not know who Sarah Clark was, but from her comments, I felt she was a Democrat, as I am. She alluded to the notion that our DA should step down. What Sandra Dorley did and said that day was wrong, but she did call the Webster chief to say a police car was following her with lights on. She did identify herself. She said she would drive to her house close by and said, I am not a threat. She's a good DA, and I've heard tough on her staff, as she should be when dealing with crime. In my opinion, she should not resign. That's from Barb. Everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Everyone's entitled to their opinion. Yeah. I think calling police when someone pulled, I mean, I was just pulled over 2 months ago for my own taillight that was out. I was actually pulled over twice in an hour.
Did you flash a badge?
I didn't. No one even knows who I am. And honestly, when the second time was on the thruway, and all I could think about was how could I pull over in a way to ensure that whoever the trooper comes up is safe. Stops on the thruway terrify me because cars go by there so fast. And that was all that actually was on my mind. I don't think anyone, that's a true abuse of power, right? Like nobody else gets to call the chief of police and say, hey, just meet me at my house, you know, follow me. I also think the police.
Also, she wasn't saying just meet me at my house. She was saying, get this guy off my case.
Correct. And you can even, and obviously the police officer himself did not know that anything had transpired. So he's still in danger and he still doesn't know what's happening. And I still think you have to keep that in mind. It's not like he was like, oh yeah, I heard you called my chief. He didn't know. He's in danger. You can't set people up for that in traffic stops. It's just one of the most dangerous things you can do.
And I would just say to Barb, absolutely welcome to your opinion. Everybody certainly is, and I respect that. The only reason I've kind of put my own cards on the table with this is such a fraught subject, and listeners deserve to know if the host has a strong opinion. And my opinion in this case, and I would love to talk to the DA about this, is if you have a bad day, I think, or a bad moment, everyone deserves grace in their worst moments. I hope I get grace in my worst moments. Otherwise, I'm going to be run out of this town or out of the studio. But when it's days later and you are lying to the community about how you used your power, then I think it reveals how you view the wielding of power and what you think you are entitled to. And that's a different thing. That worries me a lot.
And I would just add on to that. I mean, the statement that she put out, which was clearly, if you don't want to call it outright, a lie.
Yeah, it was lies.
Definitely sure. Mischaracterized what had happened. And, you know, what is that saying? That your character is mostly revealed when you can say something that no one else can confirm or know, right? Like, what do you say in those moments when you think you have control over the narrative? Well, she had control over the narrative in that moment. She said what she said, and it's only because we had body cam evidence video that totally countered what she said that we know something different. And that, I feel like, says a lot about her character.
Let me wrap up with just a couple of quick ones here. For the second year in a row, the governor was able to successfully defeat some in the legislature's push to raise taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. Where were you on that one?
you know, I think there's some things we could do there. We poll this every year, and New Yorkers firmly believe that those who make million, $5 million, $10 million a year should pay more, and the burden should not be on our middle class. I agree 100% there and think there's more work to do. I do want to say we made historic investments in the city of Rochester for the first time, $25 million for the anti-poverty money, and also an extra $5 million in AIM funding for the city of Rochester. I think these will be great resources to do some of the work that we know needs to be done in our communities. We push back on the school cuts, which you mentioned earlier. I do feel like that was a legislative win. Our schools really, they not only did they need those dollars, given that the COVID dollars are leaving, but they also had already we had already promised them as we committed to fully funding Foundation Aid, and then to all of a sudden cut them. They were in a real tailspin and thinking about having to like truly lay off teachers. So those were some good things as well.
Support for migrants, $2.4 billion to help New York City address its migrant crisis, which, of course, is not just a New York City issue. We've seen several hundred migrants in Monroe County since last July, coming up on a year. And I don't know what the updated number is, but it's significant. So are you comfortable with that number?
Yeah, I mean, people scream, why are we giving money to illegals, undocumented, whatever you may say. The migrant crisis and the refugees that come up here through this, or the asylum seekers that come up through this process, that is the legal process. We have to support, we have to give resources to it, because we should not let local governments bear this burden on their own. Obviously, the main fix is a federal one, right? We need to update our immigration laws. We need to give the resources to make these cases go before a judge in a few weeks, a few months, not a few years, right? These are all things that could help, but are not getting done at the national level. So we did at the state level have to come up with a way to ensure this is not a burden on our local governments. We do know, last number I heard, I think was over 160 new children at the city school district. I mean, we have to give the city school district support to do that.
Let's end on an up note. What's the happiest place to be in summer in your district?
Happiest place, probably my front deck or any of the front decks of my neighbors. It is quite a wonderful block to live on, and we love our summers to catch up with everyone.
And your neighbors are neighborly.
They very much are.
Well, that's nice to hear. I do appreciate the time. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Assemblymember Sarah Clark from District Number 136 is part of our ongoing series of conversations with state leaders in the wake of the passage of the New York State budget. More to come in a moment.